So conductive anodic filamentation, basically you build a circuit, you build a system, it runs, it works fine, and then suddenly, abruptly, it fails, and it fails completely. So you get a short circuit between two features on a circuit board, for example. And what's happened is the system has been exposed to, of course, a bias, so there's a voltage gradient between two points on the board, so a plus and a minus. There's some temperature involved, usually, and there's humidity. What happens is the humidity, of course, goes into the substrate, into the base material of the printed circuit board that's being used. Within that substrate, there are also some ions available, so some conductive particles and bits and pieces that can be picked up by the humidity and dissolved by the humidity. So you form a kind of miniature plating cell, and the bias, of course, drives the reaction. Temperature, of course, increases the rate of the reaction, and eventually a little filament grows from the anode to the cathode on the circuit board or inside the circuit board. And this little filament grows and grows and grows and grows like a plating cell, basically, until eventually this pathway turns into a conductive filament that actually shorts the circuit board out.
That's my guest, Alan Morgan, next on Reliability Matters.
Welcome to Reliability Matters, a podcast for the electronic assembly industry. Each episode covers topics related to reliability, best practices, and environmentally responsible assembly techniques, with insights from experts across the electronic assembly industry. Now, here's your host, Mike Conrad.
My guest today is Alan Morgan. He is a technology ambassador at Ventec International Group. Our conversation today is all about cars and the increased reliability expectations associated with their electrical systems. The electronics in modern vehicles provide an unprecedented level of safety, not just for the driver, but for those people and objects around the vehicle. Because our cars go in and out of harsh environments, the circuit assemblies within the car are subjected to heat, humidity, and other sources of moisture, which contribute to reliability and therefore safety. We'll discuss one of the primary failure mechanisms of circuit assemblies, an issue that can affect the reliability and the operation of the safety systems within the automobile. It's a real issue that, for many, is not well known. I spoke with Alan from his office in Scotland. Alan Morgan, welcome to the program. Thanks for joining me today.
That's my pleasure, Mike.
Well, before we get into the reason I invited you on the show, which was an article that you wrote, which just really caught my attention, let's talk a little bit about Alan Morgan. You are a technology ambassador for Ventec. Tell me, A, what is a technology ambassador? I love that title. And B, what is Ventec? What are they all about?
Well, a technology ambassador really is a job title and a job that fits me perfectly. I really enjoy technology, and I like going around meeting people and talking to them. So these are the two functions that come together with the ambassadorial role, I guess. I spent my entire working life in printed circuit boards, and primarily in printed circuit board materials. So I retired a few years ago after more than 30 years with one company. Ventec, who is a laminate manufacturer as well, base material laminate manufacturer based in China, but owned by a Taiwanese company. They're listed on the Taiwan Stock Exchange. is a very vibrant, growing company with a lot of speciality areas, and some of those areas include low loss materials, high speed materials. Some include IMS materials, so insulated metal substrates for thermal management. Some include an automotive sector. So a real whole range of things that attracted my attention. So my job basically is to talk to people, which I do. I travel around the world in my other role as the chairman of the European Institute of Printed Circuits. I go to all the major trade fairs, and I give lots of papers around the place, and that's what I've been doing for Ventec now. So really trying to promote some of their products, and actually feed information back to the company as well about where the market is moving, where the growth sectors are, and where the technology is moving. So it's a role that works both ways. I'm working with some old friends, and I'm working with a company that's very dynamic. And I think that's the bit that I really enjoy. Ventec is present throughout the world. I mean, they manufacture in China and in Taiwan. but they have an own supply chain throughout the rest of the world, through Europe and also through North America. So they have a global footprint, but with a, as I said, a very nice range of products, which you know, you could say are niche products, but they're pretty big niches, and you know, there's a lot of scope for technological advancement within their product portfolio. So that's the bit I really quite like.
Yeah, very good. And I think any company that embraces the concept of a technology ambassador, someone to go around and and talk about the technology, not necessarily and not exclusively about the company itself, but about the company's technology, I think that is a very wise, forward-thinking move on their part.
It's nice as well, because I don't get involved in commercial discussions or the, you know, the operation or the management of the company at all, which in the past I did used to do in my former employment, but now I can focus on technology alone, which is something I really enjoy. I mean, I'm a metallurgist, materials technologist by training, and right. I love the technology and always have. But in my career, I've been involved, of course, in many other things, in management as well, and some operations in the past, some businesses. But actually, the technology is what I love. And getting back to technology alone is a real pleasure for me. So that's why it really fits for me. And hopefully it fits for Ventec as well.
Yeah, very good. Now, you mentioned that Ventec is actually headquartered out of Taiwan and listed on the Taiwanese stock exchange. If their manufacturing is also in Taiwan, does that get around any potential tariffs?
They have manufacturing in Taiwan and in China. I mean, obviously, the tariff position has been an issue, I think, for all Asian manufacturers. Although, of course, there is manufacturing in Taiwan, which gives them some relief. But the main manufacturing is in China.
Right. Taiwan's more the control and the management.
But there's also a factory there. But certainly, the tariffs have been an impact. I think everyone's been impacted by the, you know, even the unpredictable nature of the tariffs. In fact, I was looking at some figures just recently showing the, you know, the scale of the tariffs now is pretty scary in many ways. But anyway, nonetheless, it's being dealt with. You know, in management, I guess, in business, you have to deal with things that are thrown at you. This is completely outside of the control of our industry. It's being imposed for other reasons. And I think it's remarkable how people have managed and found ways around this and continue trading around the world, because we need to trade around the world. It's essential that supplies and goods pass between the different regions. We have different specialities and different market sizes and market needs, so that way has to be found. And I've always found business to be pragmatic. Unfortunately, governments tend to be rather dogmatic.
Yeah, that's true, which forces businesses to be pragmatic.
Brexit problems.
This is not a political show by any means, but I a couple of points. Number one, I think the whole issue of tariffs will soon be resolved one way or the other. And I'll let people read into that what they hear. And I think a lot of people really don't have a good understanding of what tariffs are. Tariffs are not paid by the manufacturer. Tariffs are paid by the buyer, by the purchaser of the product. You know, hoping that it'll drive the product up to a price where the manufacturer will have a hard time selling them. But it really is, you know, the residents of the users of the product, the residents of the country that impose the tariff, that actually pay those tariffs. But business has a way of overcoming, and businesses are quite pliable, and they see what's in front of them, and they adapt very chameleon like.
And what I found in this particular case is, you know, the tariffs are, you know, do have an impact. There's no doubt, and you know, the price pressure is something that gives a lot of headaches to many people. But you find that businesses find ways of cutting costs elsewhere, so they adapt to some degree to accommodate the change in the tariff or the increase in tariff. And of course, when the tariffs do get removed, which will happen eventually, you know, I agree with you 100%. There will be a resolution. Of course, the gains that you've made in accommodating it stay. So actually, there is at the end point. There's actually a benefit, even though it feels pretty painful as you're going through it. So sure. I'm confident we'll come to the end point and actually things will be better again and things will work fine again. And whatever the winners and losers are, you know, I think in the end the consumers will get a better deal in the end, and it'll all be good for everybody.
Right. And I think the manufacturers, I'm not speaking specifically of Ventec, I just mean in general as a business move. I remember when the airlines were hit by suddenly rising fuel costs, they responded by charging for luggage and charging for to pick a seat and charging for seats that weren't the worst seats on the plane, but they weren't anywhere near the best seats on the plane. They came up with all these tools to bring in extra cash to make up for the rising cost of jet fuel. And of course, when jet fuel came back down to a normal price,
we're still paying for bags and
yeah,
and
sure,
bad
they
seats,
all stayed.
Right? It all stayed. So it was probably good for business overall, maybe not quite as good for the consumer.
I was thinking the other way around, sort of, rather than, you know, finding new things to charge for, you know, in our business, supply chain is a large part of the cost. Then the and there are things you can take out of the supply chain cost. You can do all kinds of things to make that leaner and more agile. And actually those things, by reducing the cost, because you're forced to, because of this position you find yourself in, those things also, you know, give benefits later to you and the customers. So everyone benefits in the end. You know, sometimes it needs a thing like this to push you to make a change. You know, you don't make the change normally and you don't feel the pressure. But once the margins get hit, the customers are crying and, you know, tariffs are hanging over you, you've got to do something. And people find the most amazing things to do to fix things up they would never have thought of normally. So, right. You know, there can be benefits, even though it's very painful. I know it's painful. I've been there myself. But at the end of it, you say, yeah, actually, you know, I wouldn't have done that had we not been under the pressure we were.
Right. When we had the, you know, what our grandkids will grow up being taught was the Great Recession of 2008,
yeah.
9,
et cetera. Yeah, yeah.
You know, our business was hit by it, as was every sure. business on the planet. And we adapted. And, you know, part of me, you know, in the big picture, yeah, I wish we never went through that. But part of me can at least recognize the value of going through something like that, because we became a better company. We became leaner. We became much more efficient. We adjusted our view, our forward view. And we became healthier in the long run. And so, you know, part of that experience, although it was painful at the time, was valuable. And we are today, you know, 11 years out, mm-hmm. a better company, yeah. a stronger company than we were before. Right. And I'm sure all those companies that did survive it are now even better off than they were before, and will be less affected by these types of things in the future.
Things come to mind. I mean, one saying is, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. I mean, that's something that you could imagine would be, you know, relevant here. The other thing that, I mean, I love old sci-fi films. And you think of the film The Day the Earth Stood Still. You know, it's something I use when I do coaching sometimes for companies. And, you know, there, basically the message is, you know, nothing changes until you're looking over the precipice. And then you can change. So, you know, there are many things we can learn from the past as well. But I think, you know, humans are amazingly resourceful. And we see that across technology as well. We also see it in business practices. So, you know, if you're forced to do something or forced to find something to improve, people do it. And it's wonderful how people have done that over the, you know, this great recession, as you called it, which we're still feeling the effects of. You know, what happened in 2008 is not over. You know, we still suffer as a result of what happened. But yet those who survived are stronger.
Yeah, definitely still feeling the aftershocks of that. So let's talk about this article that you wrote for Printed Circuit Design and Fabrication. It definitely attracted my attention because it hit on a couple of things that I have a passion for. One is cars, the other is electronics, and the third is reliability. It was all wrapped up into one nice article. And the title of the article, which appeared in August of this year in, again, Printed Circuit Design and Fabrication, is, will self-driving vehicles sharpen our focus on reliability? The nature of ADAS, A-D-A-S, could revive CAF fears, conductive anodic filament fears. There's obviously a lot of acronyms in that short title. Tell me about the motivation for the article and your experience with and your concerns about self-driving cars, autonomous vehicles, and reliability as it pertains to that subject.
Well, the CAF thing sort of came in there as a reliability feature. But I mean, I think the thing we have to think about is the way that our experience of driving and vehicles is going to change. I mean, I mentioned ADAS, your advanced driver assistance systems, in the start of the article. And of course, we're used to these things now. We have the, you know, the automatic braking. We have the collision avoidance systems. We have the, you know, the blind spot detection. All these kind of things are there. We have, of course, limited self-driving, of course, in vehicles. So that's all going on. But I'm thinking sort of a bit further down the line from there and how the model will change. Certainly for me, you know, when I was a kid, I wanted a car, and you know, the car gave you your freedom and gave you your I don't know what the word is, mobility. So a car was a major coming of age. But actually a car is only a way of getting from A to B, really. That's what it is, functionally. And I think we're going to come back to that function as time moves on. So rather than focus on the vehicle and the mechanism, people will focus more on the journey. And if you can imagine the position in the future, and in maybe 10 or 20 years from now, when vehicles are automatic, so basically you want to go somewhere, you plan a journey, you tell your, Alexa, whatever the equivalent of Alexa is, I want to go to San Francisco tomorrow, please get me there. And then these AI systems will calculate the best way of doing that. And maybe a vehicle will turn up at your doorstep, driverless, the door opens up, you get in, and it takes you the first part of the journey. It may take you the whole way. It may take you to a railway station. It may take you to a Hyperloop terminal. I don't know what the hell it'll do, but something along those lines. And then you'll carry on the journey. So the vehicle, which you used to own, used to sit on your driveway 98% of its time, only ever being driven 2% of the time, will suddenly be used a lot. And you won't own it anymore. It'll be owned by somebody else. And it'll be doing journeys for lots of people. So it'll go from your application, your need, to somebody else's. So there's a bit of a change here, because the first thing is, the vehicle will actually be used, rather than being used 2% of its time, it'll be used a lot more of its time. So more synonymous with a car owned by a hire car company now, where they let this thing out, day in, day out. So it gets a lot of usage. It racks up a lot of miles in a very short space of time. And that in itself is quite stressful for a vehicle. Most vehicles that we own right now, do nothing. The only bit that stays powered up is the alarm system. That's the only bit. The rest of it is mainly off, and it comes on when we need it here and there. So that's going to be quite a change, this duty cycle movement from having 2% uptime and 98% downtime is going to change to probably 50-50 or 60-40 or 80-20, who knows where that will go. So you'll have a vehicle having a much higher duty cycle of actually being active, which will, of course, affect reliability. The other big change is the move towards electromobility. So I think we all know the way this is going now. We're not going to be driving around in gas-guzzling vehicles or diesel or what the hell in the future. We're moving more towards electric vehicles, and maybe hydrogen fuel cells will be in the mix there as well. But electrical vehicles, do bring another dimension to all this. Never mind the control systems, the ADAS systems, never mind the electronic functions we have in our engines now. These things are driven by motors. So you have a lot more power. You have batteries in there as well. And then you also have the charging side. So instead of a system that's running at maybe 12 volts or 24 volts or 48 volts, which are the sort of common standards right now, you get vehicles running at 400 volts or 600 volts, or you get even testing is being done now at over 1 kilovolt on electromotive systems. So that's a massive change, and that's where I think I could talk about CAF, which is the conductive anodic filamentation.
Before we go down that road, I definitely want to talk about that, because that is a problem larger than people realize. It's one of those problems many manufacturers have, I can't say experienced, they've had that problem yet not actually experienced it, because they didn't know that's what they were experiencing. CAF sometimes forms one small short. It may or may not ruin the board, but a lot of people don't really realize what just happened. And so we'll talk about that in a second. But a couple of points. Based on your conversation, on your statements, you talked about cars will become, a means to an end more than they are right now. That will just hop in a car that's scheduled to come by, will drive us to another location, almost like a subway car on the surface. And I'm just wondering, I agree, that's the future of cars. And I'm just wondering then how the people who are car nuts, the car culture, I live in Southern California, and we definitely have a car culture. We certainly don't have a mass transit culture, because there's not a lot of mass transit. I live about 40 miles from Los Angeles, and if I were to take mass transit into Los Angeles, it would probably take me 4 hours, on various buses and trains. It's just, we're not set up for that here. We're set up to drive. And because I live in an area that's very car-centric, the types of cars we drive speaks to the person. That's a shallow statement, and it's a sad statement, but it's true. People look at the car you drive, the zip code you live in, your area code on your telephone, all these materialistic things, but it has been wrapped up as part of our culture. And I'm just wondering how the concept of autonomous cars and particularly going down that thought process where we really may not own a car. Maybe we will just have a car like an Uber type service without a driver. We're certainly going to have to make a lot of adjustments in parts of the world where cars are part of someone's identity. And that includes the way we drive the car. You know, I live just a mile away from a high school, and the worst place to be at 3 o'clock every weekday afternoon is on a road next to that high school, because all the testosterone charged boys looking at the girls walking down the sidewalk, you know, like a peacock with the feathers, their version of the big peacock feathers is the accelerator pedal. And, you know, they spin donuts and they blast the music and, you know, it's just part of the culture. It's just going to be an interesting transition as cars become really just a means to an end.
And it's a cultural thing. I mean, you know, how things have changed, you know, in my lifetime. I mean, I used to cycle to school. You know, I had a bicycle. That's how we used to do things. You know, the school where I live, I live in Scotland. I live near a very popular school, one of the big private schools in Scotland, you know, where my boys went. But every afternoon, there's like a stream of cars that go outside the school waiting to pick the kids up. You know, when I was at school, that never used to happen. People used to walk to school. So, you know, cultural changes happen over, you know, short and longer term timeframes. I mean, you know, we've only had automobiles for, what, 120 years or something, I guess, something along those lines.
And ironically, they started off as electric cars mostly. The earliest cars were electric cars.
Yeah, funny, we come full circle. But I guess before that we had horses, you know, and I guess people would show off their horse, you know, whatever they used to do. So these things happen. But I think the change will be forced on us in the end. I mean, we're being forced away from fossil fuels, of course. Forced away, I say that not pejoratively at all. I'm just saying that basically that's what's going on. We will eventually run out of fossil fuels anyway, so there'll be a need to move away from, you know, from gasoline as a fuel. Hydrogen might be the option going forward or whatever. So there's certainly a change in that kind of way of doing things. And of course, we're still being urbanized. You know, the population is still moving from the countryside to urban areas. And urban areas, even though I fully agree with you, you know, mass transit systems in many places don't work. They're atrocious. Urbanization is the first step towards an efficient mass transit system. I live in Scotland. I live in rural Scotland. You know, there's like one bus a day goes through my town or something, or perhaps exaggerating. You know, here, I ride a motorbike, which is a great thing to do, and I have a car, and, you know, I have a bicycle, and we can walk around. But actually, you couldn't survive on the mass transit system here. It wouldn't get you to work on time. It wouldn't get you to where you need to be. But that doesn't mean it can't do that, and I think... you know, if there were to be a mass transit system that worked, people would begin to use it. And I'm thinking of places like, you know, I visit Asia quite a lot. If you go to Seoul, for example, or you go to Taipei, you know, you have a wonderful MRT system that actually works. You wouldn't dream of taking a vehicle in these cities at all. Because the mass transit system actually works. It's easy, it's convenient. Look in Tokyo is another good example, where again, it just works. It's low cost, it's comfortable, and it's easy to manage and work with. So if you can imagine a stage in the future where you know, AI is being used to plan your journey for you, so rather than you having to turn up at the station and try to work everything out for yourself, you know, you have some assistance from an artificial intelligence system that works it out for you and then tells you where you need to be and when, and then deals with the rest of it. Actually, it can be quite interesting and a good way forward. And in the end, then you'll get vehicles, of course, being used for leisure. You know, a vehicle, actually, the function of a vehicle actually is to get you from A to B. That's what it's designed for. But actually, I'm with you. I mean, I enjoy driving. I enjoy riding my motorcycle. You know, the actual A to B bit is sometimes secondary for me. I enjoy the actual experience of the journey.
Yeah, so do I.
And that's going to change. You know, I mean, although you know, it's possible to enjoy a journey on a train as well, and some people enjoy very much, but I think, you know, the you mentioned before, the testosterone fueled you know, tire burning and donuts and stuff, that'll still be possible, of course, but you'll go somewhere special to do that.
Right.
I live
we'll
about 5 miles from a race circuit.
Yeah,
exactly. And that part, even though we could do it on the road, but that's getting more difficult now. I mean, I can certainly recall when I was a young man driving very fast around the place, it was possible. These days, if you do that, you know, you end up losing your license because there's so much technology in place to stop you. So we are being pushed away from that anyway, and that kind of behavior, even though when we were kids it was fun. It actually, it's not only not fun anymore, it's not possible anymore in many cases. So I think we will see that change in the in the culture. And it'll take a while to come through, but you know, there's many people now. We've seen these climate protests in the last few months growing and growing. Whether we agree, whether we don't agree, it doesn't really matter. You know, there is a groundswell of opinion now taking us in this direction, and urbanization will continue. And I think pressure on this dependence on self-controlled transport will have to change as well. And I think it will change, maybe not in, you know, one generation completely, but in a couple of generations we'll see probably a massive transformation, as we have in the last 50 or 100 years in our attitude towards vehicles and our independence by using our own transport.
Sure. Before we dive into the technical side, one more point on how we are just in a full circle environment. We talked about the first cars in the earliest days were electric, and then Henry Ford kind of went over to the internal combustion model and changed it for, you know, almost forever until now. In the United States, particularly in the eastern part of the United States, a lot of the electricity generation plants still run off coal. And, yes, you know, we burn coal to boil water, to create steam, to turn turbines, to make electricity. So in many respects, you know, someone who comes home from work and plugs their Tesla into their garage outlet are basically, you know, we come back to the coal days. That is a coal-fired car. And if we look at the source of the energy used to power that car, the source of the source is coal. So we have, in many respects, kind of come back full circle. You know, we're burning coal to power transportation, and you know, we're not doing it in steamships anymore, but we are doing it to create electricity to run our lives in many parts of the world.
It's true, and there are many examples of that. China will be another good one right now. So what you're saying really is, or what the conclusion is, that you're moving the pollution away from the urban areas to somewhere else where the power generation plant is. Right. And that's a very valid argument. But of course, coal, living in Scotland as I do, we don't have any power generated by coal here anymore at all. It's completely finished. We closed the last deep coal mine here around 7 or 8 years ago now, so there is no coal power here whatsoever.
When I was dating my wife in Scotland, they had, you know, coal fires in all of the major rooms. Yeah. and a little coal closet downstairs, and coal would be delivered every week, and they would stoke the fire, and coal also boiled the water for the immerser for the hot water heater, and you just had a coal fire going all the time. And the buildings, yeah, you remember those days. The buildings in Glasgow or Edinburgh were dark, and they just looked like they were always dark. And then as coal was removed and replaced with natural gas and electricity, a lot of the major cities started sandblasting their buildings. And my God, underneath that coal, you know, covered black surface were these beautiful, lighter colored, brighter colored buildings that we had just, you know, forgotten about.
Yeah, in fact, the house I live in has coal fires. We don't use them very often. We use them for burning logs now and again. But I actually exposed some of the front of the house. It's made of stone. And the old part, the Georgian part of the house, which is 200 years old, was actually black, as you mentioned, yeah, because of all the pollution that was around at the time. Right. So, you know, we've come a long way from that. But, you know, yes, there are alternatives now. And,
absolutely,
you know, you think about how much energy comes from the sun, for example. You know, the energy from the sun is being now harvested in a lot of different ways. You know, personally, I'm a big fan of hydrogen fuel cells. I think this is a technology that is really wonderful and actually fits very well with electric vehicles, because you generate direct electricity. You haven't got to generate, power to heat water up to make steam to run a turbine, which, you know, still to me seems pretty inefficient. You know, that's how nuclear power works as well. It does the same thing. You know,
absolutely,
the heat source is different, but you're still making steam and running a turbine. Whereas a hydrogen fuel cell, of course, doesn't work that way at all. It takes hydrogen in the cell, oxygen from the air, there and actually combines those together to create electrical charge, you know, electrical potential, and that then drives the motors or the batteries. So, you know, there's many ways around this, and I think, you know, just to move the pollution from the urban areas to some rural areas or some power plants would be the wrong thing to do. And of course we've done that to some degree, but that's not the end game. The end game is, of course, to make the power generation clean as well, and clean that power, will come. Yeah, there's absolutely no doubt that will come. It's coming. It's a pity, in my opinion, and it is only my opinion, that perhaps nuclear power hasn't been has had such a bad rap, let me say, because nuclear power has lots of benefits. I understand people are concerned about safety. I understand that. But on the other hand, this is a very clean source, and it can, of course, be entirely renewable as well.
Well, you know, not to get too political, but I wonder how many people annually die of pollution-caused illnesses, people with compromised immune systems, things like that, caused by, you know, fossil fuels being burned versus, you know, the nuclear accidents. Nuclear accidents are terrible. They're like plane crashes. They're dramatic. They're magnets for the media, and rightly so. But overall, you know, how many people do they affect? How many lives do they change in a positive way by creating clean electricity?
You take coal mining in general. I mean, my grandfather was a coal miner, and he had scars on his hands, you know, from cuts he'd had down the mines. He didn't see daylight for many years. He worked on the, you know, on the underground during the daylight hours. Mining itself kills people, kills a lot of people through accidents and also through you know, lung disease, of course. So that, right, you know, that's a direct consequence of mining coal. The estimates I saw recently were that over 1 million people a year die in China alone through the pollution caused by burning coal. And of course China's dealing with that. China is moving very aggressively away from this kind of approach now, because they understand that this is an issue. And I think all of us can learn from that example, because, you know, even though we think we're living here in the West in developed countries, you know, there are, you know, significant hundreds of thousands of people dying a year because of pollution in our cities caused by, you know, coal burning or by vehicles right now. So actually, you know, if you take that side of things, how many people die a year from coal as against how many people have died in the entirety of the nuclear industry, you just can't compare these figures.
Right.
It's a massive difference. Again, it's a political opinion, I have to say, to some degree. But, you know, the facts are the facts. And, you know, of course, people are scared about, you know, nuclear power plants because it's something that's unseen. And, you know, Chernobyl was a big wake-up call, I guess, for us over in Europe, but, you know, they're few and far between. Like you said, it's like a plane crash. When it happens, it's pretty bad, but they don't happen very often, whereas the coal thing is there all the time. You know, all the time it's eating away and it's causing, you know, chronic breathing conditions to people and disease and killing people. And so, yeah, that's the other side you've got to consider.
That's the main advantage of going with electric cars in this case, because electric cars have the possibility of producing clean energy to run those electric cars. Internal combustion engines, whether it be gasoline, petrol, diesel, there is, you know, we can make it cleaner and cleaner, but we can never make it completely clean. And so if we stay with internal combustion engines, we will always have some degree of pollution. If we go with electric, we have at least the possibility of having a completely benign, from an environmental standpoint, energy source.
I think that's the right way to view it, Mike, as well. That is the right way to view it. I mean, nothing is perfect, but actually that gives you the possibility to go in that direction.
Absolutely, because we don't have that possibility right now.
Yeah.
Let's talk about technical stuff. We're going to get back into cars and the nature of your article. You know, one of the things that, when we spoke yesterday in preparation for this interview, that we talked about was, you know, the electronics in cars started off, you know, in the radio, and then worked its way into other devices. And many of those devices were fun. They were put in because we had the technology to put it in, but they weren't really life-saving or safety enhancing. They were gimmicky things in the early days. And, you know, the ability to unlock your car from a distance, you know, was probably one of the earlier electronic marvels put in a car. Yet that really wasn't a safety issue. If it failed, you can still unlock the door with a key, or if you're inside the car, pulling up on the knob. And then we got into infotainment stuff. We can listen to satellite radio in a car, and we could listen to AM and FM, and we can program our stations, and we can maybe have even the station name or the show that the station is playing displayed on a screen. Or we could see our distance to empty. versus just a analog gauge. All of these things were interesting, and they were fun, but none of them we really relied on to, you know, complete the journey safely. We've now morphed into, with the electronics and cars, we've now morphed into a situation where if any of those or many of those electronic systems failed, our lives are now at risk. So we have, in a very short period of time, it's like we went to sleep one night and woke up the next morning and all this stuff is in a car. Between airbags and adaptive cruise control and lane departure warnings and all this stuff that keeps us safe, it went from being a novelty to now we rely on it. And now that we're relying on it, we're not driving the car as much as we were before. We are riding in the car more than we ever have before. And now all of a sudden, these electronic systems are important. They are just as important as an electronic system on a A380 in the air. So tell me about the content of the article and what your concerns are with electronics, particularly in the automotive world, and what the industry is doing to improve reliability now that it has become more than just entertainment.
I mean, we have to be careful on the comparisons here between, automotive safety and perhaps aerospace safety. Aerospace safety has a number of ways of achieving safety that are not available to us in vehicles. For example, I mean, the A380 has redundant systems, so you have more than one computer. You have two. You actually have three computers doing the safety critical functions. That doesn't occur in automobiles for a number of reasons. Because of cost and because of weight in some cases as well. So we have to sort of be careful on the options that are available to us. Of course, we do have redundant systems on braking, for example. You know, braking is done through hydraulic systems, electronic systems, but there's usually a mechanical backup. So, you know, if you press the pedal hard enough, the hydraulics will eventually slow the vehicle down. So some of that goes on. But, you know, we don't have two engine management systems in our vehicle. We only have one. We don't tend to have, multiple systems, infotainment. We have one GPS system. We don't, you know, if that fails, it's not so critical. But if we come to the stuff that's really important, the collision avoidance stuff, that's where it gets quite interesting now. So many vehicles now have multiple systems around collision avoidance and around driver assistance or advanced driver assistance. So, for example, a vehicle may have a LIDAR system, so a laser detection system, may have a microwave checking for vehicles ahead and checking the profile of those vehicles and vehicles behind coming towards you. It may have ultrasonic systems as well. And it may also have vision systems. And vision systems are actually really interesting because the vision system basically is a camera in the front of the car or the back of the car or wherever the hell it is, with a GPU, so a graphics processing unit that can actually do all kinds of things. So these systems now can recognize hazards. They can recognize traffic signs. They can recognize speed limits. They can recognize roadside furniture. And it's all part of this kind of V2X concept, which is vehicle to other things. X is other things. So it could be infrastructure, it could be other vehicles. So I think there is some redundancy being built into vehicles now because you don't just have to rely on the radar or your LIDAR system. You actually do have a vision system as well that can be used together with these other systems to give this kind of redundancy. Even though they're used for different things, sometimes you've got like the fail-safe of the brakes will come on if the vehicle calculates you're about to crash. And of course, there's a number of interesting areas around this about the human interface as well, how the human interacts with the vehicle. So I listened to a very interesting doctoral thesis recently where this was based on alertness of the driver. So there was a calculation being done in the vehicle that said, okay, this guy is driving the vehicle now hands-free, basically. So the vehicle is on autopilot. The system, the car was then looking around and deciding on what the hazards were. And it was deciding there will come a point where I have to give control back to the human because I can't deal with whatever may face me. How long do I have to pass that control back to the human? And what state is the human in? So the system was looking at the human, seeing what the human was doing. Was the human sleeping? Was the human with his hands on the wheel? Was the human reading a book? What was the human doing? And how long would it take to get the human back on track to control the vehicle? And it was then deciding at what point it would need to have intervention. So that's quite an interesting development as well. well. So the system actually becomes pretty intelligent and knows about giving control back as well to the human pilot of the vehicle. I found that pretty quite fascinating.
Yeah, it is. General Motors, I think their name for the semi-autonomous driving mode is called SuperDrive or something to that effect.
Right.
And they actually have a camera built in to the dash that looks at the driver's eyes. And it can tell if the driver's looking straight ahead or if you look to the left or look to the right or up or down for more than whatever threshold it sets, a few seconds probably, it will vibrate the steering wheel or send you an alert to,
to bring
heads
you
up.
Control,
right,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
And I guess that is so that it can hand over the responsibility of driving back to the driver at a moment's notice without having to wake them up.
And the question is, how long is that moment? How long does it need? And it works out how long it needs and then knows when it has to intervene. And that's pretty smart stuff. And the more we move on, the more AI can help us with that. And of course, now we're talking about 5G interconnectivity of vehicles with low latency, talking about a matter of perhaps 1 or 2 milliseconds now, as opposed to current 4G, which is probably 20 or 30 milliseconds. So, things can be done in real time now. And that is there's a massive change. But coming back to this sort of reliability, per se, automotive systems really have an incredible focus on safety and reliability. So the testing that the automotive suppliers do is really phenomenal. They really make sure that the life of the vehicle is guaranteed within the parameters of their system. And I think in terms of electronics, we talked about the CAF earlier on, the major manufacturers of these safety systems in vehicles have their own methods of testing for CAF, and they have their own test vehicles. And I say some of these now run over a kilovolt, by the way. So, they are pretty advanced. So that's coming along. But the other side of things, I think it's also quite interesting. You think about the camera in the vehicle. I mentioned before, the camera's doing a lot of things now. The camera's really very smart indeed. It's identifying objects, it's analyzing the risk from those things, it's analyzing the speed limit, what the hell is going on. Imagine the case though where you buy a vehicle, and using the traditional model we have today, you may own a vehicle for 3 years, 5 years. The vehicle life itself might be 20 years. That's a typical lifespan of an automotive a car, let's say. You can't imagine that camera system that you buy in the vehicle today would still be useful to you in 15 or 20 years' time. Think of your mobile phone, for example. I mean, nobody would be seen dead with a mobile phone that was 20 years old with a camera from 20 years ago. It would be terrible. So there is a thought as well that as things move on, you'll need an upgrade path on the electronics in the vehicle. So you buy the vehicle with the camera technology as it is today, which is pretty good. But imagine what it could be like in 5 years' time. And it may be necessary for your vehicle to have that improved capability in the vision system to live with all the other vehicles in 5 years' time. So probably you'll end up with a system whereby you don't just keep all the electronics in the vehicle in the same way that you have to change your tires, you change your timing belt, you may change some other parts, you change the engine oil and so on. Perhaps you'll also change the electronics as well. So perhaps there'll be a program over 1, 2, 3, 5 years whereby you bring the car in, they give you an upgrade, and they upgrade the camera system, they upgrade the LiDAR system, they grade your collision avoidance systems to the latest technology. And that'll be quite a big change because we just don't do that right now. I don't know about you, but you buy a car, with a GPS system in, 5 years down the line, all the roads have changed and it doesn't really work anymore. But that won't be something that'll be acceptable in the future, because the vehicle will require the vehicle-to-X or the vehicle-to-vehicle knowledge and to be part of this broader infrastructure to improve our safety. So therefore, you'll need to make sure your car is up to speed and running at the right level of software and hardware in the future. So I think that'll be also a big change
in the aviation,
on this journey.
In the aviation world, that's what's done now. I mean, there are still planes flying from 30, 40, 50 years ago, and the cockpits get upgraded. Collins Aerospace and other similar companies make a good living building modern cockpits for older planes. And the systems are brought up to date. The analog instruments are gone, all glass cockpits now in older aircraft. I used to fly Cessnas back in the day, and the only glass in that cockpit was the ones covering the analog gauges, that you tap when things get stuck. And and now those same planes, the actual planes that I learned to fly on, which were all analog gauges, are now equipped with glass cockpits, like tiny little Airbuses or Boeings, but they're Cessnas, and and they have a Cessna version of very automated equipment in it. And it's the same point. We don't do that with cars so much, but I like that
point.
No,
we don't.
I think that's coming.
Yeah, we add little features here and there. We may add some, you know, go faster stripes, or we may change bits and pieces. Like on our motorcycles, we do the same thing. But you don't really change the fundamental part of the systems, and that's something that probably will come along. It's a good example actually, because what aerospace does, could well come forward to vehicles.
Sure.
In the same way, for example, the big airlines don't even own the engines. The engines are leased from General Electric or from
Rolls-Royce. Or, yes.
And,
exactly.
And they take care of them. You know, they basically say, okay, you can use the engine. Every hour you fly, it costs you whatever, but we take care of the whole thing for you. We bring the maintenance schedules. We'll take care of all the issues and the upgrades with it. So that again is a model that could well be applied to automotive in the future. But I think, you know, these are interim steps. In the end, we will have, you know, fully autonomous vehicles, and that'll be a step whereby all these features will have to be integrated and managed, because, you know, I do genuinely think the model of car ownership that we're so used to now will come to an end at some stage, and that will be quite an important point for us. But the other point on the reliability in general, I mean, just going back a step, if we think about vehicles and how much electronics is critical now to the function, I mean, I think in a vehicle now, something like 40% of the value, or perhaps even slightly more now, of the vehicle's value is electronics now. So electronics are doing everything. And as you said before, if the electronics fails in a vehicle, you can't even open the door. You know, everything sort of comes to a stop. So it does become pretty critical. And you certainly don't want your stability control system to fail in the middle of a skid on ice on the freeway or something. So there are elements there that have to be really well controlled. And I think the point on the CAF we discussed, you know, CAF is an issue that has been with us since the 1970s, or been known about since the 1970s.
Let's explain what CAF is, Alan, for our
so,
audience.
So, conductive anodic filamentation. Basically, you build a circuit, you build a system, it runs, it works fine, and then suddenly, abruptly, it fails, and it fails completely. So you get a short circuit between two features on a circuit board, for example. And what's happened is the system has been exposed to, of course, a bias. So there's a voltage gradient between two points on the board, so a plus and a minus. There's some temperature involved, usually, and there's humidity. What happens is the humidity, of course, goes into the substrate, into the base material of the printed circuit board that's being used. Within that substrate, there are also some ions available, so some conductive particles and bits and pieces that can be picked up by the humidity and dissolved by the humidity. So you form a kind of miniature plating cell, and the bias, of course, drives the reaction. Temperature, of course, increases the rate of the reaction, and eventually a little filament grows from the anode to the cathode on the circuit board, or inside the circuit board. And this little filament grows and grows and grows and grows, and like a plating cell, basically, until eventually this pathway turns into a conductive filament that actually shorts the circuit board out. And that's conductive anodic filamentation. That's the classic description of it. So you need temperature, you need humidity, and you need bias, you need voltage. You also need a pathway. And we, of course, conveniently provide the pathways, because glass fibers within the substrates do form a very nice pathway between conductive elements. And we always have ionic materials in there that can be dissolved and mobilized by the humidity. So there's always a potential for this to occur. But of course, if you consider going back sort of 20, 30 years, where electronics was generally held in custody, let's say air-conditioned rooms, temperature, humidity controlled, this hardly ever happened. In fact, it just never happened in those situations at all. But you look at a vehicle works in the Arizona desert, and it works in the ice of Finland. It works in high humidity conditions, it works in pouring rain, it works in dry, arid desert conditions. So it has the whole range of let's say environmental conditions, and some of these, of course, conspire to give a higher risk of CAF in a vehicle. And of course, CAF can't be allowed in a vehicle in a safety critical system. The vehicle has to last for 20 years. It's designed that way, and it mustn't fail. The companies who supply these kind of systems to vehicle manufacturers have, you know, very, very elaborate systems for controlling CAF and for testing for CAF. And CAF, in the end, the propensity towards CAF, or the tendency for it to occur, comes down to three things. One is the design. one is the materials used, and one is the process. And all those three things come into play. And certainly from the design point of view, I think we all understand now we're building systems smaller and smaller. We're making smaller and smaller features. The smaller and smaller the gap between anodes and cathodes, the higher the problem or the bigger the problem. You know, when we had 3 or 4 millimeters or half an inch, let's say, between conductors, this is no problem at all. When you get down to, you know, 10 mils, maybe 5 mils, this is becoming quite critical. And we're certainly going that way more and more. And that is as the real driver, I guess, for this. So over the years, there have been some solutions to improve the performance with respect to CAF. One of the first things was purity of the substrates. So in the early work in the late 70s and early 80s, quite a few impurities were found in the substrate. So there were lots of ionizable groups that could be mobilized and form the electrolyte, if you will. These were improved, and over time, higher quality controls were placed on the raw material. So that was an improvement. Then there was a phase where the main curing agent that was used was discovered as being not fully reacted in some systems. This was able to be dissolved by the humidity and again form the electrolyte. So that was replaced with a material that didn't have that effect. So these things have been going on and on and on to improve the performance for CAF. But on the other hand, you know, designs are still getting more critical, and environment vehicles are being used in is more and more critical. So this is a never-ending story, and we have to continue to work on this and actually test test real systems. You know, you can't do an exercise on a bit of paper for this. You need to actually take the boards, the design, and test coupons and have them tested. And there are around the world some very good test labs that do this testing on a very regular basis, and that is an integral part of this problem. And the other thing I mentioned was process. You also find, you know, process has a big impact on CAF performance. You may have the same design, you may have the same materials, but a different process can have a big impact on the way the board performs. A good example there would be, for example, you have a circuit board or circuit board company that maybe uses a very aggressive etchback after desmear. So the gap between two holes might be nominally, let's say, 10 mils, and they might actually, aggressively attack the bond between the glass and the resin to take away perhaps a mil or 2 mils either side from that. So when you thought you had a 10 mil gap, you actually end up with a pathway that has to only span maybe 6 or 7 mils, and that could be quite a big issue. So process comes into it. I have seen research work was involved in part of it some years ago, whereby we compared 3 different board shops for the process using the same designs, the same materials, and the performance differences were massive. You know, they were as big as choosing the material, the wrong material. So, one should never forget that. The process is an important part of this. And that's why you see the tier one automotive suppliers really take a very big interest in their suppliers, the tier two suppliers of the printed circuit boards, to make sure the process is controlled and understood. And the process that they tested is the one that's actually being used in the design. So it's quite a bit in there, Mike, but it's a very deep topic, and I think it's one that does warrant some attention. It's something that people may not fully understand, but it's because of all these things, the usage and the design, it really is going to be a topic that'll be on the table, I think, for years to come as well. As long as we have glass fibers, as long as we have potential to form pathways, we will have CAF concerns.
Sure. I was speaking with a friend and colleague, Judy Warner, who I know you know.
I do,
from
yeah.
Altium a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about this big disconnect. I was on her show, and I'm not a board guy, right? I'm an assembly guy. And yet there is this huge chasm of this knowledge gap between the assembly folks and the board folks. You know, you're a foreign industry. You're an alien industry. And somehow, through this giant chasm, you hand me a product, and I take it from you, but I really have no idea how it's made. And I know there's many exceptions to that statement, but as a generality, as a stereotype, bathed in, realism, that's true. And I was working with a company. This is several years ago. My audience has heard this story too many times, so I won't go into it in detail. Where I was hired as an expert witness, and it was a CAF issue, and it became very clear that, CAF is something that occurs within a board. So one can say it's a board issue, even though there are things the assemblers can do to exacerbate the propensity of calf, you know, multiple thermal excursions, you know, lack of baking, et cetera, et cetera. But it's largely a board caused issue, made worse by the assembler. Yet the assembly folks had no idea, never heard of calf before. They had no idea how calf could be avoided. They had no idea that there were more calf resistant materials from suppliers like yourself and others. They just had no idea about that. And I think the assembly people kind of blame the board people, and the board people might do the same in return. I'm not sure. But there is this huge knowledge gap. And it's really important from an assembly standpoint, particularly if a board is going into a harsh environment. You know, an automotive is like the poster child of harsh environment. If reliability is expected, if the cost of failure is high, then there really is an advantage to the assembly people, you know, communicating with the board people, with you guys, as to what the reliability expectations are and the climactic in-use environment that that board is going to see. Because otherwise, if they just put on their spec sheet, you know, FR4, with no other slash sheet or no other bit of information, in this cost crazy world of board fabrication, where everyone just wants the cheapest board from delivered the fastest way, you know, we lose the information that will allow folks like yourself who can offer up a variety of different board materials and production methods to adequately address the concerns of the assembler. You know, those conversations don't happen often enough.
No, it's true, and you know, the more we do this, the better. I mean, I was you know, I wanted to be invited to give a keynote at the Altium Live event last January. Judy invited me to that, and that was great. I did this, of course, on behalf of Ventec, and you know, I was able to explain in the space of an hour. You know, quite a bit about my knowledge. My knowledge is very shallow. Well, it's not very shallow. My knowledge is very specific. It's around PCB materials, but it, you know, it goes pretty deep. And the designers in the room, of course, don't know anything about PCBs or how they're made, or about how the materials that go into them are made. So, in the space of an hour, it's amazing how much knowledge you can pass just from your own experience. And I think that is the real thing we have to think about. And you know, it's not enough to just consider the PCB as a simple component. This is actually a very, very complicated component, and actually a component that you can vary and specify in lots of different ways. I mean, I was involved in a case a few years ago where a board failed for CAF with an automotive supplier, and you know, the board shop came to talk to me, and we discussed around this. But of course, the test they'd applied to the board, the CAF test, wasn't disclosed to the board shop. So the board shop had no idea of the actual use case for the circuit they were building. Had they known the testing that was going to be required, we could have specified a different material and we could have passed the test quite easily. But because the test wasn't communicated, you know, from the end user to the board producer, that discussion never took place. It was never mentioned. And that's the kind of thing that's a disaster, really, because, you know, all the information is there. You can get solutions to these issues, but you need to communicate together to do that. You know, CAF is something that all manufacturers understand very well now. I mean, in Ventec, you know, we have a very keen focus on this, and you know, one of the most important things when it comes to eliminating calf or making materials more calf resistant is to watch how you treat the glass fibers. The glass fibers or the fiberglass that we purchase has a finish. There's a silane coating on there that's designed to bond to the resin system. So in the end, we end up with this so-called siloxane bond, so silicon, oxygen, silicon, that actually gives you a physical, so a chemical bond to the glass fiber, which means that the pathways are very hard to form. And of course, in order to make this work, you have to wet the glass fibers with the resin. Now, you know, there are systems, very big, fast-running treaters that don't give much time to actually cause the wetting to occur on the fibers. Whereas in Ventec, that's been addressed, and the systems are designed to give more time and to actually allow the fibers to wet out fully. There are other methods used in there as well, but it's something that's there's an awareness of, and that wouldn't have been the case 20 or 30 years ago, I have to say. So those that have been investing in the recent past in new equipment understand this, and they will then select equipment that gives them this this potential from at least an engineering point of view to get the wetting correct and give a better performance. But yeah, I think the the nub of it comes down in the end to communication, and just to be aware that there is an issue or potential issue is the first step. And I applaud the work that that Judy is doing with his Altium Live events, and I'm sure the work that you've done as well to try to communicate the requirement from the assembly through to the end user, from the board shop supplier, and also the supplier of materials to the board shop. All of us have a part to play in this, and actually to get the right solutions, we all need to participate in this discussion. We can't just treat it as by the lowest cost item and specify it like you specify a resistor. It's not that simple. It's far more complicated than that, and you can have far more influence on the final performance than people might first of all imagine.
That's right. Yeah. Printed circuit boards are the foundation that we build our livelihood on, and our products on. And when we build a house, we would never go for the cheapest foundation. We don't build upon sand; we build upon rock. And there are sandy boards and there are rocky boards out there to carry that lame analogy out a little further. I think the industry would really do itself a favor. Our industry, your industry, if we communicate more as to what the reliability expectations are and the environment that the boards are going to go in, so we can get the right materials the first time. And I've said this many times on this podcast, but that's just further evidence of we don't have time to do it right, but we'll find time to do it over. If we can just not do it over, we just do it right. Because how much is failure? Failure is expensive in so many ways. In actual dollars and cents and pounds and pence and euro and all that, and in reputation. And some
reputation
of it is
a huge cost.
It's huge.
Absolutely.
And how do you put a price on that? It's hard to quantify.
It really is.
Alan, this has been
a very important point.
This has been a really fascinating discussion. Thanks for being part of it. And I know a lot of this kind of went off the technical realm, and we got to talk about everything from horses to steam engines along the way. And
sorry about that.
I love it. I love it. I think that's what makes a great conversation. Alan, if people wanted to get a hold of you for whatever reason, what's your email? Is it okay if I provide that?
Yes, that's alan.morgan@ventec-europe.com. Or head over to LinkedIn. You'll find me there.
And it's Alan, A-L-U-N, Morgan.
U-N, yes.
Yes.
Yep.
If you type A-L-A-N, you're going to get some poor guy who's an accountant somewhere wondering what CAF is. So,
right.
So thank you very much. And the company you're representing is Ventec International Group. And they are a manufacturer of printed circuit boards.
Printed circuit board materials.
Materials, yes. Oh, thank you. Yes, of printed circuit board materials. Going to the fab shops. Your product is probably already in our customer's portfolio. They just don't know it.
Exactly. It almost certainly will be, yes.
Very good. All right. Well, Alan, thank you. It's been a great, interesting interview. Thanks for agreeing to be my guest today.
That's my pleasure, Mike. Thank you for having me on.
Well, that's another episode. Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Reliability Matters on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcast. Reliability Matters and other reliability-based podcasts are available at Circuit Assembly's PCB Chat at pcbchat.com and at Ascendo Reliability at reliability.fm. Thanks for your comments. Please keep them coming. Send comments and episode suggestions to mike@mikeconrad.com. That's Conrad with a K. Until next time, thanks for listening and keep doing it right.
Thanks for listening to the Reliability Matters podcast. Join us on the second and fourth Tuesday of each month for new episodes of Reliability Matters.